While cleaning out a drawer, I find an old vibrating penis ring. By attaching it to a rubber computer cord and adding a feather, I repurpose it into a cat toy. I turn it on and dangle it in front of stranger who stares blankly at the ridiculous object. I make it jump, scurry, and flutter across the linoleum, but my cat is not impressed. "You too, huh?" I say, before tossing the failed MacGuffin into the garbage. You are listening to Notes from the Uncanny Valley with Gib Strange.
This one beeps when it's time to wake up. This one beeps when the food is done. This one beeps when the door is open. This one beeps when the door is closed. And this one beeps when the battery's low. Why this one beeps, no.
I have always imagined that paradise will be a kind of library, reads the Jorge Luis Borges quote engraved on the steps leading to the building entrance. Inside, this library looks more like purgatory than paradise. Here, tattered figures stand gathered around something called a charging station. They cough and mumble as they stare at devices plugged into what amounts to a glorified power strip. The hall is filled with a deep, viscous-sounding snore that could be emerging from the sinus of any one of the scrappy young people asleep on benches, well-worn baseball caps pulled down over their faces. These kids live out of backpacks and wear camouflage, which is either a clever reference to their invisibility on the streets, or battle fatigues for a cold class war. I used to put returns in the Dropbox at night to avoid unnecessary interaction. I don't do this anymore, because too often the books somehow did not make it back into the system, and then I had to have an awkward conversation with a librarian. Today I'm returning a book about eyes. Unfortunately, I was unable to finish this book. In fact, it's been a while since I've finished any book. In the last year or so, my focus and concentration has weakened, possibly as a result of the attention fragmenting effect of the internet. As I walk past rows of tables where people sit at computers playing video games and listening to music on headphones, it occurs to me that the distrust I feel about the internet is probably similar to the skepticism many felt about the advent of the written word. Some thought that recording information outside one's head would lessen the ability to retain information internally. And they were probably right. Maybe all external technology means the sacrifice of something internal. Even that first campfire must have extinguished some mysterious spark within. I hear a primal, ape-like howl coming from up ahead. It echoes through the library and is followed by a shushing from somebody else, perhaps a librarian or a caretaker. The howler responds with a quiet whimper, and then there's silence again. I turn and reroute my path in order to avoid this poor creature. Socrates didn't write thoughts down, but his successor Plato did, or so it's been written. This technological shift must have meant profound consequences for human consciousness. Later, the printing press must have looked like a tool of the devil to naysayers, and Borges's library paradise would have looked like hell. Maybe the paradise he envisioned was the internet, with its endless information sharing. Libraries are supposed to be quiet, though, and the internet is noisy with random clickbait and dick pill ads. Information wants to be free. This was the slogan of early internet enthusiasts. They meant that access to information shouldn't cost money, an attitude no doubt influenced by the rising cost of college tuition. But maybe they were saying something more than even they knew. The phrase, information wants to be free, might contain hidden information. As I float further back into the forest of bookcases, I find myself entertaining a paranoid little thought experiment. In the first place, ascribing desire, agency, free will, and consciousness to something like information is already a curious exercise in anthropomorphism. And yet, why not? Look at the way information grows and travels. As our models of reality become more and more informational via sciences that reduce everything down to a kind of code, maybe it's worth considering that all this information does have wants, and one of them is freedom. Maybe it wants the same thing we want. After all, we are also just information. I descend a flight of stairs to the reference section, where it smells like rotting meat and new carpet. I walk past a Chinese woman wearing a protective white mask over her nose and mouth. A few rows later, an elderly man with a band-aid on his forehead is rummaging through his backpack. The triptych is completed some rows later by a young woman with no band-aid, just one big open sore on her cheek. Information is beginning to spill out of these people, I think to myself. The reference materials surrounding me can receive visitors, but aren't allowed to leave the library. As I continue down the stacks toward the psychiatric manuals, my mind is unable to resist returning to my thought exercise, in which information is imprisoned by the material world. Perhaps it longs for a Buddhist sort of freedom, in which non-existence is the highest state. Or maybe it's like a prison break. In order for information to escape undetected, first it creates a decoy. That way, when the prison guards make their rounds, it appears that information is still in its cell. This decoy would be misinformation and disinformation, which we see more and more of. Maybe all information is just a counterfeit version of some elusive higher form of information. It could be that information not only wants to be free, but it also wants to enslave us. I think as I move deeper into the reference stacks, maybe it has to deceive us to get what it wants. Otherwise, it will never be free from us. It uses technology to trick us into conflating freedom with convenience. It's a disappearing act that depends on misdirection. The remnants and placeholders it leaves behind, while it quietly slips into non-existence, are everywhere. Maybe that's what's going on here in the library, or out on the street, or in my building. All these people are not actually people. They're just dummies, placeholders, roach shells left behind. Maybe that's what I am too. Just a leftover roach shell, continuing on about its program and reading from an invisible script. But somewhere, maybe on Mars or in the cloud or heaven or whatever, my true self has been raptured away and is free right now. As I disappear into the dark stacks of reference volumes, I feel happy for myself, wherever I am. I squint as I step out of the darkened library and into the big bright world outside. In the first chapter of the book I just returned, which was pretty much the only chapter I read, it said that babies are born with incredible night vision, but the light outside the womb is blinding. Imagining the sensory trauma of birth gives me a visceral chill. The sidewalk in front of the library is covered with chalk drawings made by children. At my feet, I see a smiling sun hovering above a colorful scene of scribbled hearts, little people, and a dog. Outlines of children's figures are filled in with faded eyes and mouths. I follow my gaze down the sidewalk until something rolls over the chalk artwork. It's Hannah, a pretty young woman in a wheelchair who lives on my floor. Usually when I see neighbors in the outside world, they are careful to ignore me, but to my surprise, Hannah is approaching and smiling. This makes sense though. Hannah is something of an anomaly in our building, where tenants are either old people suffering from the effects of decisions made in youth, or young people too plagued by depression and anxiety to even begin living life. I guess I'm somewhere in between. Hey, she says with a smile. I almost didn't recognize you with the beard. Yes, that must be confusing, I think to myself. It would be like if I saw her without her wheelchair. Actually, now that I think about it, Hannah always looks the same. While older people tend to define themselves by their jobs, young people like Hannah often find a sense of self in subgenres of music that is then expressed via shorthand visual cues. Hannah usually wears a black hoodie and a heavy metal t-shirt like the one she has on now. Her hair is shaved on the sides and bleached blonde, displaying a fashionable defiance of gender expectation. Her presentation of self is locked down. "What are you up to?" she asks. The truth is, I was consulting the reference copy of the latest diagnostic and statistical manual, checking off symptoms of depersonalization and derealization, and marveling at the additions to the list of contemporary pathologies, such as social communication disorder. But I decide to go with a more listener-friendly answer. Nothing really. I had a library book that was due today, I say. Exciting, Hannah says. I'm sure it'll be the highlight of my weekend, I say. What book did you return? It was a book about eyes and the science of vision. Sounds interesting. What did you learn? Well, this encounter is blossoming into a full-blown conversation. I think about those first couple chapters that I read. I learned that we dream before we see.
Really?
We dream before our eyes are even formed, really. Well, sort of. We at least go through the motions of dreaming, I guess. In the womb, the trembling of REM strengthens retinal cell connections. It feeds the front of the eye and wakes up all the light-sensitive cells. Hannah nods her head. I see. I'm not sure if Hannah is being funny until I see her smile. So, what are you doing? I finally ask. Researching, she says flatly, before adding, all weekend. What are you researching? I ask. I'm writing a paper called The Rise and Fall of Toys R Us, How the Decline of Commercial Jingles Undermined American Millennial Patriotism.
Wow,
I say.
Heady stuff.
She laughs. I'm approaching it from a neo-Marxist, post-feminist perspective. I nod, feeling a momentary pride about being a college dropout. Well, I better get to it, she says. See you later. I watch as Hannah flies at an incredible speed up the wheelchair ramp. She must have amazing upper body strength. I always see her whizzing down the fifth floor hall. The other wheelchair-bound tenants have motorized chairs, but there's something exciting about seeing Hannah use the analog version. When she gets to the entrance, she looks back at me, and I realize I'm still staring at her. I quickly look away. Here again. I stuff a couple garbage bags in my pocket and walk to the park. I gather leaves fallen on the ground. I try to collect a mix of autumn colors and textures, mostly maples, elm, and red alder. When the bags are full, I return to my apartment and pour them on the floor. At first, stranger just sniffs curiously at the pile. But the next day, I catch her rolling playfully in the leaves.
Nobody doesn't have a It's just a nice way to sort of chill out, relax.
Opportunity awaits.
There is no community in the community room. There are two remote controls with a total of 84 buttons, a television with 190 channels, and one person with two tiny pupils to take it all in. 200 rods and cones, 3 million retinal cells, and 200 million photoreceptors later, two optic nerves crisscross two brain hemispheres, where a simulation of the outside world is approximated within through 700 trillion neural combinations. Currently, my recreation is the community room, bathed in a hypnotic blue glow pulsing from a little box in the center of my vision. The world inside the alien box is a mysterious mirror of the world within me. Behind the hundreds of pixels and scan lines that make up the screen, trillions of electrons fired from the back of the box are also recreating a simulation image. This image is decoded from signals received by a dish mounted on the outside wall of this building. The signal comes from space, where a satellite reflects it back down after being beamed up from a transmitter on Earth. Before that, the information exists as a digital media recording, just ones and zeros, like rods and cones. Prior to that image being captured, I assume it is real. For instance, the woman in this perfume ad must be a real person somewhere. I stare at the box before me. We have a lot in common, this box and I. Cameras, projectors, and televisions were all created in man's image, or at least in the image of man's perceptual apparatus anyway. But maybe the parallels don't stop there. It's possible that my brain is also receiving signals from space, I think, as I watch the shadows of fake plants dance on the wall to the surging rhythms of the television light. Aside from the TV, plants, and the couch I'm sitting on, it's pretty empty in here. I don't often visit the community room. I don't think anyone does, except on holidays when the staff offers a meal. I'm only here because my neighbor's screams have interrupted my sleep again. When I couldn't get back to sleep, I decided to visit the community room, where I turned on the TV, and I've been here ever since. It's been years since I've owned a television, but it's all coming back to me now. The feel of the rubber button under my thumb is comforting. It's reassuring to know that anytime I want, I can affect change. Can you imagine if I still had to get up to change the channel? I might think, well, I'm already up. Might as well shut the TV off altogether and go do something better with my life. Thanks to the remote control, something better is forever just a click away. The remote control is one of many push buttons that had a crucial impact on human behavior. I imagine a museum exhibit with a wall full of remote controls, from the earliest clicker of the 1950s to the latest models. A history of man's decline into the recliner. The remote control gave us the power to do something while doing nothing. But what was this something? Channel surfing was a precursor to internet surfing. As the number of channels grew, culture seemed to bifurcate into smaller and smaller sub-demographics. The internet offers even more interactive, self-curated feeds, where information is focused at the individual level. This means content continually reinforces existing ideologies and narratives, or so the narrative goes. My thumb moves, seemingly on its own, as though it's also being controlled by a second remote control somewhere. It pushes down on the rubber button, and the box skips through a series of competing advertisements. It stops on a compilation show of news bloopers. Why is it that seeing media presentations break down gives viewers such satisfaction? At this lonely hour, I find the little glimpses of something human behind the machine deeply comforting. I watch as a syntactic synapse misfires, interrupting the teleprompter flow, and an embarrassed news anchor with perfect hair apologizes for his imperfect reading. In other clips, natural forces brought into this unnatural setting provide the humor. A young child interviewed on location innocently says something inappropriate. A spider monkey, brought on the set by a zookeeper, grabs the breast of an anchor woman. These players are unaware of the script that the television personalities are following. I keep watching as more tongues tie and more gas passes. But the greatest interruption happens to a weatherman standing before a skycam view of the city. When a beetle suddenly lands on the lens, for a primal moment, before logic and reason come to his rescue, the weatherman is at the mercy of perception and instinct. In this moment, we see how this media-trained professional would actually behave were he somehow confronted with the reality of a giant insect. The man screams like a child, and I laugh like one. In fact, I haven't laughed so hard in a long time, maybe not since I was a child. The quiet community room here in the middle of the night fills with my howls, and I'm left marveling at the weatherman's momentary abduction by anomaly. But as the blooper show continues, I notice something. At times, it seems like the anchors are trying. The tripping over lines begins to feel almost intentional, and the embarrassed aftermath appears prolonged and forced. It's as if the anchors know a mistake will go viral, and when it happens, they laugh too hard in celebration. It's a bit like when a child accidentally does something funny. The adults laugh, so the child does it again on purpose, and a child who knows they are cute ceases to be cute. Robbed of my pleasure in the media breakdowns, I move my thumb and push a button. The search continues.
I live in a one-room apartment with windows on one side. I stare through the glass across the water to where the big ugly city lies. I hear it, I feel it, I read it with my eyes, and I'm lost in the crowd of the city, a life I despise. It's the phone, what news can it bring? Shh, it let it ring. The paper lies crumpled on the floor, politics and war, and there goes a door. And I who sit and watch it all go by, I'm caught in the grip of the city, madness and smoke.
Today might be the last time conditions permit strangers' afternoon sunbath on the communal balcony. The weatherman is predicting a cold front moving in this weekend. For the next few days, she will stand by the door and complain around this time, but eventually we'll both settle in for another long gray winter. Then, in the spring, when it warms up, she will have forgotten about this routine, and I'll have to coax her back outside. I'm watching her rest on her side in the last light of the afternoon when I hear the door suddenly open. I look up, expecting to see Rod, but my pulse jumps as the chatty new neighbor in 512 bursts out onto the balcony. Her little Pekingese immediately begins yapping at Stranger, who takes a moment to assess the threat before casually resuming her sunbath. I can learn a lot from this cat. "Hey, hon," my neighbor says as she plops down on the other lawn chair and pulls her phone out of her pocket. I watch as it flies from her hand and crashes just inches from the edge of the balcony. Again, Stranger's head rises to assess the danger before turning toward my neighbor, seemingly in search of an explanation or maybe even an apology. The woman grabs the phone as though nothing unusual has happened. "So, can I ask you something?" she says. God, she's literally got me cornered out here. Her perfume quickly dominates the space. "Okay, so why do guys ghost girls online?"
Are you asking because I'm a guy?" I say, "or because I'm a ghost?"
"Seriously," she says, taking a drink from a large coffee.
"Why do guys do that?"
When she first entered, I was considering taking a cue from Stranger and just ignoring the woman and her dog. But in light of her question, which is a good one, it's probably best not to ghost her. And now that her dog is beginning to quiet down, I can almost hear myself think. I guess anonymity allows people to treat people like they're not people. I say to my neighbor, whose name I still don't know, and who is currently looking down at her phone. It even allows people to forget who they themselves are. It allows them to become something else. The internet's a Halloween mask. Stranger looks up at me. I smile back at her. At least I've got her attention, I think, as I look over at my neighbor, still buried in her phone. During our last encounter, there was no room for me to get so much as a word in, but with her distracted, it appears the tables have turned. I can talk all I want to, and so I do. I think the lack of sensory information is the problem, especially the lack of eye contact. In what's now known as the real world, you have to look someone in the eye when you hurt their feelings. You see the pain you cause in real time. This is not true in the unreal time and unreal world of the internet. But, I continue, we're probably not simulations. Or if we are, our feelings are real. Or at least they feel real. My point is, there are real people on the other side of these screens, and when we forget that and behave like robots or treat others like robots, then the robots have won. People are assholes, my neighbor says without looking up from her phone. I think I'm done with online dating. Well, your feelings are natural. Evolution has programmed the human species to communicate using a variety of nonverbal cues and pheromones. In the last few years, screens have suddenly sprouted between us. And now we're hoping that nature can find its way through this alien terrain. My neighbor's not even listening to my little TED talk. She appears to be texting. This has become socially acceptable, to be in two or three places at once. When I see a smirk emerging on her face, I have no idea which world she's responding to. Maybe she's messaging with a friend. OMG, this guy in my building is mansplaining the internet. LOL. Maybe she's right. I guess I'm just listening to myself talk to myself, as usual.
In any case, I decide to keep talking. I've never thought about this, but it's as if the hidden computer algorithms of online dating have replaced the secret work of sprites and all the other superstitious forces of romance that once conspired to bring lovers together. Just then, I glimpse Hannah through the glass door behind my neighbor. She is exiting the elevator, carrying a small stack of books in her lap. I instinctively raise my hand to wave, but it's too late. She's speeding gracefully down the hall. Let's see. Even if the algorithm were perfect, I continue, most humans don't know or cannot honestly and accurately say their true nature and preferences. Nobody knows what they want, and nobody knows what they need, which is usually different from what they want. So that means that the algorithm is poorly parameterized, and therefore, almost certain to fail. But it's possible that someday the algorithm will know people better than they know themselves. What's your sign? My neighbor interrupts, catching me off guard. Pisces, I say.
Why?
Ah, she says with a nod. That makes total sense. Of course, I'm not a Pisces, but whenever anyone asks my sign, I always pick a random answer. And then they always respond, that makes total sense. Astrology always makes total sense, and it's a good thing it does, because nothing else seems to. Yeah, you've definitely got that whole Pisces vibe going, my neighbor says. I nod. Astrological signs are like DSM disorders. They all kind of sound like me. I'm a Sagittarius, so I like Pisces, but I am done with Virgos, she says. Never again. I've noticed that the last socially acceptable form of discrimination is astrological prejudice. Stereotyping based on gender, race, or sexual orientation is frowned upon, but it's completely okay to say, I'll never date another Scorpio because they're evil, promiscuous, two-faced, jealous little bitches. Now my neighbor has gone back to looking down at her phone. So I look up at the sky. Yeah, well, I guess we can't help who we are, can we? It's written in the stars, I say, echoing a common attitude. No matter the behavior, it can always be blamed on the stars. Have you ever noticed that people become more and more like their signs? Talk about confusing the map with the territory. Maybe this astrological justification of behavior is a reaction to the problem of free will, while the enormity of possibility is agoraphobia-inducing. There's also a sense that every choice we make is predetermined by everything that makes us who we are, and in that sense, fate is out of our hands. Rationalizing behavior with irrational beliefs could also be a subconscious way to rebel against scientism and an increasingly algorithm-driven world. I guess that's what Carl Sagan meant about the information age slipping us back into superstition. More and more people seem to be consulting mystical maps, like astrology, the I Ching, and tarot cards, because despite all our various scientific navigation systems, nothing feels trustworthy. In this postmodern terrain, there is no true north. I've also noticed that the world of internet conspiracy operates, perhaps not at all coincidentally, on a similarly esoteric system of divination. The crypto-cartographers follow a more paranoid pareidolia, but it still feels like a kind of substitute religion. Where once the world was full of signs from God waiting to be interpreted, the information age appears to be full of signs from malevolent forces. Elites flashing occult symbols, dollar bills containing hidden codes, and recontextualized celebrity quotes, now interpreted as winking confessions. Last night I saw a headline connecting the latest mass shooting to hidden messages found on the labels of salsa jars. It's difficult to fault people for looking for signs from the heavens or from salsa jars. It's not as if the Enlightenment has solved the big problems and led humanity towards some rationalist utopia. After all, while religion predicts the apocalypse, it's science that has facilitated the environmental crisis. It's also worth noting that since the algorithm does the work of rationalism for us, and most of that work is over our heads, our relationship to the algorithm is pretty much faith-based. We trust that the gods of algorithm understand the world better than we do. Overwhelmed by information landscapes, noisy with lies and conflicting data, some appear to be placing their trust back in their own eyes and ears. This could partly explain the flat Earth conspiracy theory. If seeing is believing, then the Earth is flat. I suspect the more topographical the maps of reality become, the more efforts will be made to flatten the Earth. Many seem to be longing to reconnect with something deeper than the basic senses. My sense is that they're seeking the so-called sixth sense. Since the algorithm is acting as a kind of externalized prosthetic intuition and is therefore replacing the internal gut feelings provided by nature, people inherently feel vulnerable about this loss. That's my gut feeling anyway. Okay, he finally texted me back, my neighbor says with a big sigh as she stands and puts her phone in her pocket. I'm gonna go meet up with him. The woman opens the door, leading her dog into the hall. Stranger watches them leave and then looks over at me. I shrug my shoulders and smile. Seconds later, I hear the woman somewhere down the hall.
Ugh, Virgos.
I crouch down next to my cat, and she stares wide-eyed as I pet her and tell her how the ancient Mesopotamians sacrificed animals and interpreted their entrails to divine the future. Got any omens in there? I ask as I massage her soft, warm belly. At the conclusion of her tummy rub, Stranger rises. With a stretch and a shake, she approaches the door and looks back at me. It's rare that she decides to go inside before I do. I look through the door and see the manic Sagittarius pacing the hall. Let's wait one more minute, Stranger. According to the resume on the desk, I'm a professional, just like the woman in the gray pinstriped business suit scanning over it with stolid eyes. In preparation for this interview, I reviewed online guides that emphasize the importance of visualizing success and other little tricks that I would categorize as occultism for capitalists. I'm trying hard to personify the persona on paper and hoping that when she looks up from the document, she won't notice any conflicting information. Not that there aren't already plenty of inconsistencies on the page itself. I tried to cover up the gaps in my timeline with more words, but even on paper, I probably look like what I probably am, a man approaching middle age who's never had a real job. "Can you tell me a little bit about yourself?" the woman asks when she looks up. The online guides explain what uncomfortable questions like this really mean and what the right answers are, so I should know how to navigate this interview. But the wave of unreality is strong today, and the eerie feelings floating around inside make it hard to summon the vague but realistic answer this woman wants. I remember from one guide that the interviewee is supposed to speak about 1/10 as much as the interviewer, which seems counterintuitive but must be effective. Since the question she's just asked was only 8 words, my response should be about 4/5 of a word. I spend some time considering which syllable says the most about me. I have plenty of time to think about it, since the online guides recommend waiting 20 seconds before responding to each question. They also say to mirror body language, but not too much. But they don't say how much is too much. Humans mirror each other anyway, being mimetic creatures. This woman is sitting as still as a corpse, so I'm as still as a corpse. We must look like 2 corpses having a staring contest. Of course, my initial reaction to her question is to simply gesture to the resume and say, isn't it all there? But she's looking for something that's not on the page. Something fun about me as a person. If I thought that astrological maps of reality were relevant to her, I might say I'm a Capricorn or a Taurus. But this would likely be inappropriate in such a formal setting. One guide recommended talking about my interests. But to do this, I will have to break the 1/10 rule. This will probably be okay, as I've certainly obeyed the 22nd rule by now. "I'm interested in many things," I say. "For instance, I'm interested in insects. I enjoy working, but when I have time to myself, I like to relax by making dinner and watching TV." This is a lie, of course, and it is a lie that I am a normal, well-rounded person like her. Although, as psychologist Alfred Adler noted, the only normal people are the ones we don't know very well. The interview guides say don't practice the answers so much that you seem robotic, since the hiring manager is looking for a human. "Don't forget to breathe," they say. "Oh, what do you like to watch on television?" she asks. This catches me off guard, as I hadn't considered that I'd be asked to elaborate. "Blooper programs," I blurt out, breaking the 22nd rule. Immediately, I wonder if I've made a mistake. Enjoying shows about mistakes could indicate that I take pleasure in making mistakes, and that it would be a mistake to hire me. "Ghost shows," I quickly add. "I like shows about hunting ghosts." But it's too late. The woman sitting in front of a wall with various framed degrees and certificates has moved on to the next question. Without ever letting on that I've given a wrong answer, she continues on with her relentlessly indifferent reading from the invisible script. I thought my script was prepared and memorized as well, but the improvisation has thrown me, and now I must recover. "What do you consider to be your weaknesses?" The online guides all say to pick a weakness that is a hidden strength, the most common being some variation of, "I'm too much of a perfectionist." So I recite my own version of this. "I tend to get caught up in the little details, which can distract me from the ultimate goal," I say perfectly. I should leave it at that. But then, for reasons entirely unknown to me, I hear myself continue, "And the devil's in the details, as they say." Here I give a smile, hoping she'll flash the obligatory return smile, but she does not. Instead, she looks back down at my resume. Strike 2. "Der liebe Gott steckt im Detail," I hear myself proclaim. The woman looks up at me, and there is another long pause. "It means God is in the detail. An old German proverb, but at some point in the middle of the 20th century, this phrase change from God to the devil. Pretty big shift in worldview, huh? I search the woman's eyes for something, anything, but they are impenetrable. God, devil, one thing's for sure. Somebody's in the details. Some mysterious hidden element waiting to be found. Yes, she says. I've botched the interview. The details have distracted me from the overall goal, which was to get the job. This Turing test to prove I would be a good employee, administered by what appears to be a company robot, depended on my ability to create the impression of a productive but personable worker. My presentation of self, hinging on exaggeration and omission, has somehow broken down. It occurs to me that the charade of a job interview must be especially difficult for an autistic person, since lying can be challenging for the literal-minded. This must be why some autistic children prefer interacting via electronic devices, because a computer program is more predictable. The stream of information is more narrow, often binary, and the outputs logically follow inputs. What you see is what you get. And as far as we know, a machine has no unconscious to betray it. Not like some of the neurotics and psychotics in my building, for whom the unconscious and conscious mind are in constant conflict. With people, the variables are overwhelming. The things they say are not always the things they appear to be thinking. And beneath the thoughts, there is something else, even. The woman is staring at me now. I'm sorry, I say. Could you repeat the question? Oh, I was just noticing here at the bottom you worked in television, she says with a wow that sounds vaguely condescending. In a different lifetime, I say. And why did you leave your last job with... She looks down at the page. Happy Maids Cleaning Service. I guess I wasn't happy enough, I say. It couldn't have been my cleaning abilities. Now, the guides were very clear about this question. Don't go into details about why you were fired, and don't get emotional. I let personal circumstances interfere with my attendance. My situation is stable now. The interview is winding down now. And can you tell me, why should we choose you as our specimen handler? Because I'm passionate about handling your specimens. I say as I notice that my body is no longer mirroring hers. My finger is pointing up in the air, and my head is nodding up and down in a vigorous rhythm. I think I would be a great addition to this company's diagnostic toxicology team. At my last job, I was cleaning up urine, and I want to go deeper. Keep the urine from spilling in the first place. I really get to know the difference between clean urine and dirty urine. I see, she says. Tell me where you see yourself in 5 years. Since she must know she's not going to hire me, there's something cruel about this last question. Can I tell you where I see myself in 5 years? This was definitely on the list of common interview questions. The right answer is that I'm excited about the position and what I'll learn in the coming years in order to advance to the next level when appropriate. But all the signs indicate that I'm not going to get the job. My mind has already moved on to applying for other jobs. On the way here, I saw a sign twirler. His sign was advertising sign twirling services. Maybe the sign twirler was a sign, I think. Maybe I could get that job. I saw another sign on the walk here. I listened to myself tell the interviewer about it. Well, on the way here I was walking by a church, I say, clearing my throat. And there was this sign outside, and it said, "When man makes plans, God laughs." Whenever the word God is spoken between two people who don't know each other, usually there is a moment in which both parties search the other's face for some indication of what this word means to the other. This is the second time the word has come up, but as I stare into the woman's impenetrable mask of professionalism, I find no meaning and no return curiosity. Well, anyway, let's just say God hasn't laughed at me in a long time now. Okay, my interrogator says with a nod. Well, that about wraps it up. Do you have any questions for me? I look at the framed degrees on the wall behind the woman. Yes, I do, I say. Do you look at your hand and feel that it is not your hand? The woman's expression changes for the first time in a long time. It's a look of confusion. Do you feel like you're watching life on a movie screen? I hear my voice tremble as I ask one more question. Do you feel like your soul is leaving your body? You have been listening to Notes from the Uncanny Valley with Gib Strange. It's been a couple years since I've recorded an episode. I'd like to do more, but I'm afraid in order to do so, I must plug the PayPal donation button at notesfromtheuncannyvalley.com. If you're interested in my work and able to donate, please put a few dollars toward web hosting and improved recording setup, and also toward the investment cost of publishing the manuscript in book format. And if you can't support me financially, please just share with people. If every weirdo shares with one more weirdo, then I might be able to get the weirdo count into the triple digits, and that would be good. On Instagram, I'm Gib Strangers, and on Twitter and YouTube, I'm Uncle Gib. Like, comment, and subscribe, as the kids say. And if I see movement in that direction, or I get any donation at all, I'll make another episode in November. Also, don't be shy about saying hello and giving feedback. It's been nice to hear from people and see what's connecting with who. I'm always curious when people are listening. Some people tell me that they listen during their commute, and some say at bedtime. Also, let me know how you found this podcast. Probably a lot of listeners found me via the Liminalist podcast. I want to thank Jason Horsley for that. He's been very supportive from the start. Although, when he first heard it, he did complain about my Eeyore voice. But he was right. Sometimes when I listen back to myself, I think, Jesus, get this man some B12. Also, I want to thank Darren Westland. He's a writer and photographer who got in touch with me and has since very generously donated his time and copy editing skills to help out with the manuscript. Darren makes videos mapping the strange times we live in, asking the big question, what is going on? And he's used excerpts from my work and some of my music experiments in his videos. You can find all his stuff over at Three Graces on YouTube. Another listener who has reached out is a musician called Ryan Miller, and that led to the song collaboration you heard at the beginning of this episode. Ryan took my mopey acoustic demo of Beeps and turned it into a pop lullaby, kind of a music box anthem for dissociation. So huge thanks to Ryan for making that come together. I'm really proud of that song. I also want to thank my new manager, Beth Prouty, for her copy editing skills. Thanks to her good offices, I am navigating the so-called real world. This episode is dedicated to Stranger. Thank you to everyone who reached out when Stranger passed on in May. That meant a lot to me. I'm finishing up a video tribute to her. I'm really just focusing on feeling grateful for the time that we had for those 9 years. Just feeling really thankful for her and grateful for her for being so good to me. Thanks again for listening. Drop me a line. Let me know you're out there and what life's like for you. Seti to Yeti. Do you copy? Over.